I'm supposed to lead a discussion on constitutive equations for dense flows. And so what I'm going to do is I prepared my normally when I give a one-hour seminar, I write 10 pages of notes for the seminar. So what I did was I wrote 5 pages of notes in the belief that if things scale linearly, 5 pages of notes will be a 1/2-hour seminar, which I believe is what I'm entitled to do. And then the idea is we then discuss it. Now, the things being what they are, I mean, the discussion may well start during the course of the talk, but I don't think we'll necessarily be here more than an hour or an hour and a half, unless people really want to dig into this. Okay, so first of all, I'd like to remind you of something that I've remarked upon a couple of times already in the last week, which is about the phenomenology of Schutt flow. And then I'd like to tell you about a somewhat simpler case where there are some simulations that are talked about in the GDR MIDI paper. And then I'd like to present what we being principally myself and Denise Ertash, have been thinking about as a potential approach to explaining these kinds of behaviors. So for Schutt flow, which is flow, unrestricted flow with a free surface down an incline, the basic rheological equation is the Poulikin flow rule, u over square root of gh is equal to a function of h over h stop of theta. And this function is approximately 0.14 times h over h stop, where the quantity h stop of theta is basically read off of the phase diagram for this flow, which shows that there is, in fact, a curve, which is a sort of generalization for flows of arbitrary height of the concept of angle of repose, which separates a region in which no flow is possible from a region of steady state flow. And then up here we have accelerating flow. Okay, so that's the basic Poulikin phenomenology. The number 0.14, yes?
I mean, so what's u? I mean, I hate that sounds like a stupid question, but this is like an average u across the whole shoot, or what is this?
We say the coordinate system is that this is x, and this is z, and vx of z.
That's
average velocity.
Then you want to map density weight.
Yeah, so density, so it's effectively the volume flux divided by the height.
Okay.
Mass flux.
Yeah, so that's.
Average velocity. U times h is the total flux down the chute. Yes, Ellie.
So, I mean, this rule uses as h stop. I mean, the phase boundary.
Right.
And the proposition is that one has to go to an experiment or a numerical, either a physical or numerical experiment to extract h stop.
That's correct.
It's a purely empirical result, and it's also only true for round grades.
Well.
They have to have.
Oh, I don't think Ellie's quite done with this question.
Well, for it to be really a rule, there has to be a rule for it stop. Otherwise, it's.
Right. I mean, Poulikin wrote down a fit for H stop. But. I mean, if you like, if you don't like my calling it a rule, that's, you know, I...
No, I'm just saying, it's an important observation, but if one can understand h top is 0.14, then we have a rule.
Okay. Well, okay. I don't want to debate what you have to do to make a rule. This is what Pulikin says. What he basically says is that there's a correlation between the rheology deep in the steady state flow regime and the position of the phase boundary. It's been seen in.
It is. I know about the experiments in Los Alamos, but to what extent is it reproducible and to what extent in general? That's,
okay.
It's a sensible thing.
Absolutely.
This is a starting point for rheological description of dense granular flows.
Okay, so I'll tell you the range of validity of this. Okay? The number 0.14 is not claimed to be universal, but is seen in experiments with glass beads, and is also seen in the numerical work of the Grest Exxon Haifa group with spherical inelastic particles.
But that assumes probably a particular coefficient of friction matched to the experiment.
The number is weakly, but only very weakly, dependent on details of coefficient of friction or even coefficient of inelasticity.
You get the same result from the Bagnall type scaling as well.
But the Bagnall is a dimension.
Is your problem with the 0.14?
I'm just trying to understand.
Okay. Okay. So the 0.14 is approximate. Okay. And in fact, the numerics gave about 0.135, and Pulikin saw something a little bit more than 0.14 with the glass beads. As I remarked on Monday, if you do this with sand and not with glass beads, which has only been done experimentally, then you find an entirely different coefficient here and a constant offset as well on the right-hand side, so that this form remains true, but the exact form of the function.
But isn't there something, is h goes to h stop, you only get the constant then?
The two constants are in fact equal. So as h goes to h stop, in the case of the sand, the formula is,
zero.
Is, right, it's beta times h over h stop
minus
gamma, and beta is approximately equal to gamma. There's about a 10% difference, but if you dig into the experiments, there's too much noise. Otherwise you're going to be flowing. If beta is not at least greater than gamma, you're going to be flowing back up the chute at threshold, which would be a bit of a nuisance. I have to say that I don't personally, I'm not convinced that this is actually true near threshold. You'll see my reasons for believing that develop over the course of this discussion. But what I suspect is that this is true for, an asymptotics that's true when h stop is much greater than the particle size and when h is much greater than h stop. Yes?
The reason I asked the question about you is, might be semantics in a way, but when people talk about constitutive equations and constitutive models and things like that in the context of other complex materials, they're usually talking about something that's in more of a local rule.
Correct.
How I calculate V sub X, not how I calculate U.
Yes.
And
we'll be coming to that.
Oh, we will. Okay.
Yes. Okay. Other questions? I think that the status at this stage of Pulikin flow rule is that it is a phenomenological observation that correlates a wide range of both experimental and numerical results. Now, what GDR Meadey claimed to do is they claimed to turn this into a local rheology, which I'll describe in a moment, as per constitutive relations, and they claimed that this local rheology can be used to characterize a much wider range of experiments than the simple chute flow example. And, I think that, including Quetzal, flow on a heap, there are six actual examples that they work with. And, you know, I mean, I think that, at some point we should, there should be a debate about whether or not GDR media have, should really be believed or not. But, you know, I don't, I haven't completely mastered their paper, so I'm not yet qualified to stake out a position in that debate. So the second example is plane shear. And here, GDR media actually refer to some numerics that they seem to have done themselves, but they don't really say very much about the nature of the numerics. One can be a little bit skeptical about what exactly they've done. But basically, they take a two-dimensional system. This is the simplest possible rheology. They take a two-dimensional system, subject it to a normal force and a tangential force, and they look at what are the properties of the flow that develop. You know, I'm very curious as to how they avoid crystallization and that kind of you know, typically two-dimensional problem, but they don't give a lot of details about this. What they do say is that defining what they call an effective coefficient of friction as simply the ratio of the transverse to normal force, that this exhibits a collapse in a scaling variable that they call I, which I will define in a moment. As a function of the scaling variable, there is basically a yield stress, some kind of transition region, and then a roughly linear region with the slope of the line in the linear region being determined by the coefficient of inelasticity of the particles. So the slope is a function of the coefficient of restitution of the particles, and the scaling variable I is equal to the diameter of the particles times the shear rate seen in the experiment. And they do claim that this doesn't shear band, that they get a relatively uniform shear rate across their cell, divided by the square root of p over rho.
It's based on 2D numerics, is that right?
This is based on 2D numerics.
What is p?
P is not f sub n. Well, I think that they discuss this very schematically. I would prefer to think of this, for reasons that again will become clear, to say that P is not F sub n, but is F sub n plus the compressive stress in the direction parallel to the flow, so that it actually is the trace of the stress tensor. I think that's the more appropriate way to set up this kind of discussion. I should say that this pure example without gravity, Bob Berenger keeps trying to do this in space, and I don't know what the status of that is, but I know has a large grant from NASA and has been pursuing doing this on the International Space Station. But the International Space Station, they're too busy fixing the toilet to actually be able to do any science there. So I don't know if our prospects of doing this in microgravity are very good in the near term.
But also want to do experiments. We did it on an air table.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing.
In 2D?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, he wants to do it in full 3D in microgravity.
So much smaller investment.
Yeah. Yes.
Little d is the thickness of the shear layer?
Little d is always the size, the diameter of the particle.
Why is this?
And rho is the...
Rho is the average density.
Number density, mass density.
Mass density. Mass density. You want it to be mass density to get the units right.
And p as opposed to
fn. As I say, I don't quite understand how they do it. The way I always do it is that I write p is equal to 1 plus k times fn. Where one might expect k to be approximately equal to 1 in d equal 2, and equal to 2 in d equal 3.
Why isn't p proportional to gamma dot or square?
Well, I mean, p is, in some kind of scaling sense, it is, in the, if this is the scaling variable.
So then you should get something that's just a function of volume fraction and coefficient of restriction.
The, that's essentially not what they're seeing. I mean, what they're seeing is that as a function of gamma dot, they see different effective coefficients of friction, and those effective coefficients of friction depend on the combination gamma dot over the square root of p. It is not, however, the case that gamma dot is, you know, proportional to square root of p in this experiment.
Because of thermal conduction.
Well, I mean, because of whatever, which in the whatever is what I'm trying to explain.
Thomas, I have a hard time with force. P is the pressure.
P is the pressure.
In which case, in three dimensions, P equals 3FN, doesn't sound quite right.
Actually, this should be FN per unit area.
And don't you want the 1 over D, or 1 over the dimension of space?
I'm sorry? Now let me get back to your question. You don't like P equals 3 times 1 applied for, if all of the compressive stresses were exactly the same, k would equal 2 and d equal 3.
No. Because if you wrote 3, you should get less than the size
of 1 plus k, pressure is the trace of the stress tensor.
No, it's not.
Okay, fine.
Fine.
Are you happy now? Okay, good. Okay, have we sorted out everything so far, or are there still questions?
Yeah, just a question about the particle interactions. They're instantaneous, or there's some stiffness?
They are modeled in terms of coefficient of restitution. I've read this part of their paper rather quickly and superficially. I didn't find very much discussion or very much, you know, of exactly what they were doing, but I suspect it's a simple coefficient of restitution type.
It sounds the same reason with the two kinds of simulations, either molecular dynamics with soft particles, either contact dynamics, and they apparently found the same result. And,
right.
I'd like to make just a general comment about molecular dynamic simulation of granular. This we learned the hard way when we tried to produce experiments on among layers is what you can simulate as far as stiffness. If you want to do realistic stiffness, it's just very time consuming.
Yes.
And one has to take some, large scale.
One has to take some liberties and make the particles a little softer.
A little softer than realistic if you really want to reproduce experimental results.
I mean,
we could do 1,000. Up to 10,000 particles to reproduce some particular set of experiments, but there's an issue with that.
I mean, you made a point for both guys, you also made experiments with most of the material, right?
With foam, for example.
Yeah. I mean, how can be simulated? I mean, megapascal, young models can be simulated.
Yeah, I mean, we actually with Gary, we did a few cases where we went up to values of the Young's modulus that were starting to look realistic. So we did, and we kind of basically went up there to make sure that it didn't cause significant changes to our results.
Thomas, are you in that pressure equation that you really mean to multiply by the dimensionality of space?
Yes.
D times
D. Oh, sorry. Thank you. Of space.
Sorry.
Okay. Okay.
So the simulation you'll be describing, the fringe groups will be, is MD or?
Well, I'm done describing the simulation.
There's got to be that. I mean, it's like Kumar said, that there must be something wrong if they've done it with. It has to be some sort of numerical artifact.
Why do you believe, why, you know, you are not you don't believe this result, which is saying that the granular fluid is behaving like a Bingham fluid.
It can't be true. There's no gravity and there's no contact dynamics. It's got to be a numerical artifact. Like, I mean, there's no other time scale in the problem. So.
There is no material time scale, right, in this particular case.
There is no no, absolutely not. This is an example of the kind of challenge that I was talking about on Monday, where they have no other microscopic time scale that can be compared to gamma dot, so they are constructing such a time scale out of D and out of something that's referring to the boundary conditions, and they're saying that it's the comparison of gamma dot to that time scale that's built out of the boundary conditions which is controlling the physics.
I mean, typically people with contact dynamics, they have to fix the simulations to make them elastic at low velocity, so it must be some effect of that.
I don't believe that it must. I mean, as I say, I don't know the details of this simulation, so I'm not in a position to defend their simulation. I know a lot about the details of the simulation side of this, and I'm confident that we know what we're doing.
Yeah.
And in fact, as I will argue in the course of this, the rheological consequences of this result are in fact more or less the same as this, modulo a few details.
I mean,
I don't start out from a position of automatically assuming that they got the simulation wrong.
I mean, this original flow just follows straight from Bagnall to Bickley stuff.
Right.
The only difference there is that they've expressed the coefficient in terms of this H stop over the particle diameter. There's nothing new about the flow rule itself.
And, well, the thing that is, the only thing that is new about the flow rule is that the Langsgostick scale H stop is appearing in the place of what would be the particle size in the original Bagnall picture.
Yeah.
Okay, but I mean, that's the same, because now you say, where does H stop come from? Because H stop is, in fact, becomes arbitrarily large as you go towards the underlying angle of repose in the problem. So actually, you have exactly the same problem that you have in this experiment, which just expressed in terms of a length scale rather than in terms of a time scale. So what Kumaran is unhappy about is that I invented a time scale here, which I can make be whatever I want to by according to what kind of pressure I put on the system. But in fact, the same problem expressed in terms of a length scale is already appearing in the chute flow example.
Maybe, Thomas, you meant making clear, a bit clearer, stating that the two laws you were, this dimensional number and the relation between U and I and this relation between U and F have only an asymptotic value. But the first one does not hold when H is very close to H stop.
Right.
The second one is not, doesn't hold.
Yes, and I actually already said that, and that's the physics of this region here.
So this region is,
and the physics of near the boundary here may be, you may or may not have the form of this function. However, I don't believe personally that it's going to be simply linear in that regime. And Poulikin says that he doesn't necessarily believe that. However, I have never seen him in print talk about any kind of breakdown of this law near threshold.
What do you see in the simulation on the behavior near the threshold?
Actually, we see it keep pretty linear down as low as we can go. So we have not, in the simulation, been able to penetrate into a regime where this law starts to break down. As I say, Poulikin states that in the experiments there is such a regime, although he has not chosen to make statements about that regime in print.
I mean, just can we think about it? You're writing a function, U as a function of H and theta.
Right.
I can think about it as a function coming out of the plane. We know that it goes to zero. Mm-hmm. You would expand it the way you would do, and either throw away the linear term or not.
Absolutely, and that's why I said that I believe that, you know, 5 or 10 years from now, when we completely understand this problem, we will understand this kind of expression as an intermediate asymptotics of this, in the case where H stop is much greater than the particle size, and where H is greater than H stop.
Some assumption of
analyticity of the function error.
Well, it's not just analyticity. It's also saying that the, you know, the dominant intermediate asymptotic is the linear, is the linear term.
No, the point is that this result seems to be rather robust. But it's an asymptotic loop, I insist on that.
Yes.
Yeah. It's H, well, because for instance, the velocity U is going progressively smoothly to zero in experiments when H comes to H stop, and not to a constant. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, it's an interesting result, well, because it holds.
It could go to zero in various ways. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Half
power. Right. Okay. Okay. Other questions? Yes, Thorsten.
I would like to ask you again to motivate why, what is the fundamental new in the polygon law? I mean, truth flow has been measured by many people.
Right.
There are many different proposed fitting laws.
Right.
Exponential decays, power law decays, many different things. What
yes.
is fundamental new in Pulikin's law?
What is fundamentally new in Pulikin's law is that he introduced the length scale of the boundary as the characteristic length scale controlling the rheology deep in the flowing regime.
The H-stop is everything which is given. Right?
Yes.
But I mean, given, I mean, what do you assume that it's a power law dependence? If it is exponential dependence, then... Other experimentalists, engineers, proposed exponential decay.
Yeah, I know. There are a lot of other proposals which involve a lot of other length scales.
Right.
What Pulikin did, which is new, was that he, sitting here, and which I think is novel and is the real physical insight, was, you know, it's not at all obvious that this flow should care at all that someplace else in this phase diagram there's a boundary line between flowing and not flowing, and that boundary line at that value of theta occurs at a value of H stop. But Pulikin's saying is that if you want to find the characteristic length scale that's controlling the rheology here, go down to the boundary, measure that value of H stop, and put that value of H stop into your rheological formula or constitutive equations, if you like, up here, and that's how you do it. Okay, so I don't think that way of approaching this problem appeared previously in the literature.
That's right. In engineering, use just fit formula. Use some quantities which are fitted from experimental data. So I was looking into the physics.
Right.
Yeah. But if it would be an exponential decay. I mean, yeah. My question is, how well is this H star defined? In the experiment observation, of course, you can make a long time, say, photograph, so you have a long time.
Right.
And you will see a sort of a boundary, perhaps.
Right.
But is it really different from an exponential decay?
Well, I mean, the boundary...
Experimental setup.
Well, I don't quite know what you're talking about when you talk about exponential decay.
You mean flow on a heap?
Yeah,
yeah. It's different.
It's very related.
I mean, I think that there's no obvious creeping regime in these flows. It is true that as you go towards this line, you have to wait an awfully long time to get to the steady state flow, which is a challenge. But the, you know, if I put the kind of error bars, either numerical or experimental, on a graph like this, I mean, if I did the scale, this would be about 18.5 degrees. This is maybe 27 degrees. And this down here might be an H stop of 2D or so. So that gives you the kind of scale of the picture.
Can you give us one more scale, which is near 18 degrees, how far the measurements went?
We've done it up to 50 or 100 deep. I don't know if Pulikin did it that deep.
How sensitive is all this to the nature of the base of the shoe.
Awfully. You've got to have a rough base.
Yeah.
If the base is much rougher than the particle,
you use second cloth.
It doesn't matter much.
You use second cloth, which was...
Yeah. And what we did in the numerics was we just made the base be particles that were frozen.
It doesn't seem to be so preposterous, this idea that H dot would matter, because H dot is telling you the thickness at which the dissipation is so strong that it prevents flow. There's a competition between forcing and dissipation.
Mm-hmm.
The balance is there. So it doesn't seem to be unreasonable to think that when you go above that threshold, the flow depends on how far above that threshold you are.
Well, let's talk on the velocity. I think it determined somehow by the balance between source and dissipation of energy.
Right.
Source due to shear and dissipation due to dissipation.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. I mean, have we beaten this to death? Can I go on?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so my purpose is basically to talk about our way of thinking about this problem in terms of the really the physics of inelastic collapse in these flows. So our fundamental claim is that this can be understood at a qualitative or semi-quantitative level in terms of the physics of coherent motion in the flows. Okay. So the starting place is just consider a ball collapsing onto the wall in the presence of a restoring force, F, that is pulling the ball back to the wall. Okay. If such a ball has a coefficient of restitution, R equals 1 minus epsilon, then there is a time scale for this collapse, which is basically 2m times the initial velocity of the ball divided by f times 1 minus epsilon divided by epsilon. Okay? And after such a time, the ball will be at rest on the wall. Okay? Now, there are a few problems with this statement. One is that this statement is actually only true in the limit of infinite rigidity of the ball. The reason is because you have to undergo an infinite number of collisions with the wall before the ball will come to rest. If the ball has a finite rigidity, each of the collisions takes a finite amount of time, has a finite duration, and therefore you actually can't have the infinite number of collisions required to dissipate all of the energy in finite time. That's a complex and somewhat subtle issue where you have to look at differences between Hertzian particles and particles with linear restoring forces and so forth. However, if you feel uncomfortable with this way of speaking of it, you might feel more comfortable to regard this as a time scale after which the ball is spending much more of the time in contact with the wall than not in contact with the wall.
Does epsilon signify a small parameter?
Not necessarily. Okay, so we'd like to apply this to neighboring particles in a flow that are colliding with one another. So in that case, we write tau is equal to rho d squared gamma dot divided by pressure times some function of epsilon. Okay, so what have I done here? Well, the first thing I did was I replaced the restoring force F by the pressure of the medium divided by d squared. Okay, the idea being that a ball moves away from a contact, a particle moves away from contact with another particle, it will experience a restoring force tending to tending to push it back together, which is proportional to the pressure. The second thing I did was I, kept track of all of my factors of D, and I got rid of the mass, and I turned it into the density, basically. So if you like, there is, you might say, this function of epsilon has some dependence on the volume fraction, but since the volume fraction is varying over a very narrow range in all of these flows, I typically won't bother with that. And then the other thing I did was for the initial velocity of contact between two balls, I just took that initial velocity to be gamma dot d, which is a local velocity scale of collision between particles. And then I put in this undetermined function of epsilon simply because, I mean, the realistic situation is you're colliding with a ball, which meanwhile is in contact with or colliding with various other particles in the flow. So, the way the inelasticity of the collision works is going to be a little different from just a two-body collision, simply because you're colliding, the two things that are colliding are in contact with a lot of other particles which can absorb energy because of impulses that are transmitted in the course of this collision. So I think that, to be safe, we should say we don't completely understand that process. So we're going to put in an undetermined function of inelasticity there. Okay. So that the next question is, what is the result of these inelastic collisions? Well, when you have two particles basically collapse onto one another in this way, you introduce correlations between the velocities of those particles. So then the question is, what is the length scale over which such correlations exist in a flow? And so that correlation length I write in the following way. So NNC, if you like, is nearest neighbor collapse. You have particles that come into contact and correlate their velocities. And then once their velocities are correlated, each of them will have other neighbors with whom their velocities will become correlated. And so now you have more than two particles that are correlated, and so forth. And this is basically a diffusive process where you have collision after collision. And each time a particle collides and collapses onto one of these particles that has formed is forming this cluster, you create a larger and larger domain of collisions. However, this can't go on forever, because on a time scale, which is gamma dot to the minus 1, every particle in the flow is going to be changing its neighborhood. And so any opportunity you can have to maintain these correlations with your neighbor, you will lose, because your neighbor will be swept away by the overall flow. So from that, one concludes that this length scale should be basically the diffusion coefficient corresponding to the creation of these correlations, which is d squared divided by tau sub nnc times the time which you have to create these, which is 1 over gamma dot. Okay?
Thomas, is it obvious that you should use diffusion to model the kinetics of the accretion?
Actually, in very low dimension, and that's actually a very subtle question all of itself, which we've given some thought to. In very low dimensions, the answer is probably not. In high dimensions, the answer is almost certainly. The critical dimensionality for this seems to be 4. So I am using this formula somewhat below the dimensionality in which I can actually justify it.
You may rescue yourself by dimensions.
No. Okay. Okay. So the so this is simply L sub B is 1 over, we'll call it F tilde of epsilon, which is just the square root of f, times the basically 1 square root of p over rho over gamma dot, and then we have the values of d here, so we have to multiply times, I think this is d in the denominator or the numerator. We had d squared over tau nnc, so actually I think we don't even have any powers of d. I think this is all we've got. Does that look right? I'm sorry? Okay. So,
I don't catch the first term. 1 over f squared, the same f we were talking about.
Yeah, same f. I just had to take the square root of it, so I gave it a new name. So I don't have to carry square roots all around the place. I have to carry tildes all around the place.
But maybe you're after the gamma dot dependence or the epsilon dependence?
I don't care about the epsilon dependence because I don't really understand it. I'm interested in where do new dimensional quantities like this come from?
So is rho proportional to 1 over d cubed in this case?
Rho is the mass density, which is roughly mass of a particle times volume fraction of the particle divided by d cubed.
So it's 1 over d cubed. Yeah. Mass is equal to 1.
Yeah. Okay. So you might already notice something interesting, which is the appearance of an object like this. This object is, in fact, just d divided by L sub e with some other factors thrown in. Okay.
With a subscript capital E, what is that supposed to stand for?
Well, capital E is this now discredited language of eddies, which it's me. I'll have to think up some other word than eddy for what the E stands for, because I can't go back and get rid of all the E's in 3 years of notes. But
Thomas, don't we need to care about epsilon, for example? I mean, we could take then epsilon to 0.999, and then we can actually measure the exponent that characterizes the behavior of this dimensionless number with epsilon.
Absolutely. So I mean, there's no.
Because in the freely cooling case, that's exactly what we're after, is those exponents. And we have their orders of magnitude of data to actually extract those, unambiguously, those exponents.
Right.
It appears that this is a related process.
Yes. You're absolutely right. And I think that the basic concept here is that epsilon should be small, like 0.1 or so, because that's where there's the most correspondence with the experiments and the numerics. But the full dependence on epsilon has not been explored.
I mean, this seems like an obvious, just tune the same simulation to 0.0001 and see whether it
works. Well, I mean, what Gary will tell you, if you go to Gary, if you drive down to Albuquerque and tell that to Gary, what Gary's going to say is that when you do that, the region of steady state flow gets pinched off, and it gets really hard to do the. It's a nuisance to do the experiments if epsilon is too small.
It takes forever.
To do the numerics, right. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm still a bit fidgety about the p.
Right.
Can you tell something more now about
p?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, where p came in was that p was the restoring force on this particle.
No, but if you look at considerable dimensions, the rheology should depend only upon the material, not upon what pressure you're putting from outside, right? Because there's a disadvantage.
I don't believe that. I mean, that's not what I believe is the case with granular materials. I believe that in the case of dense granular materials, the constitutive relation depends very strongly on the pressure.
Well, the pressure has got to be equal to the material's response in that direction. Whatever it is.
I guess I don't understand that. That statement's a little too vague for me.
Okay, there's no temperature scale in the problem.
Correct.
Right. So if you share the material, the temperature is basically being determined by the strain rate itself.
Yes, the conventional kinetic theory temperature. That's correct.
Or even the temperature of the fluctuations of the particles.
Right.
So that is what is going to determine what the normal forces are.
I actually think it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Okay. How is it more?
Well, first of all, I mean, it's an assumption. If you have the case of inelastic collapse, as I'm claiming, or you have particles that are in contact with one another more of the time than they are out of contact with one another, one can have structures that communicate force that are, you know, basically force chains in the flow that are communicating force without the need for thermal collisions between the particles. Okay. Now, all right.
Those are simple spanning force chains.
Not necessarily.
But also, if you don't constrain the volume, and you increase the shear rate, the sample will expand and the frequency of collisions will decline.
Sure.
So the pressure will be self-correcting in some way.
Mm-hmm.
That's...
Well, it's still got to be related to the strain rate somehow. If there's a function of...
Well, the pressure, I mean, let's consider, for example, shoot flow. In shoot flow, we know what the pressure is.
Yeah, sure.
The pressure is rho gz cosine theta. And that's fixed by just the need to hold up what's above you.
So the strain rate adjusts itself to that, so that it generates the pressure to hold up the material above.
Well, that's fine, but you're getting way ahead of me, because at the moment I'm not talking about how the system adjusts its strain rate so that this L sub E has whatever value is needed to have a self-consistent flow. All I'm saying is that there's a length scale L sub E that is constructed out of these two. It's, you know, dimensionally obvious that such a length scale can be constructed, which is why GDR MIDI were using that length scale in their paper. What I'm saying is that this length scale has a physical interpretation in terms of the diffusive formation of regions of correlated flow.
Another related question is, I remember in the previous talk, yourself or Gary, were shown two pieces of stress, one collisional
mm-hmm.
and one contact
right.
related. And the collision was about an order of magnitude smaller than the contact.
That's correct.
This explanation relies heavily on the picture of multiple collisions, at least a series of growing number of collisions between particles that dissipate a lot of energy
mm-hmm.
to extract this
right.
important length scale. And how do those two observations can be reconciled, or this observation of this?
Well, I mean, actually, there's another way of doing this whole thing, which is actually deals a little bit more carefully with this whole issue of thermal energy, okay? And I don't want to describe it because it involves a number of subtle ideas, and you know, I think this is going to be tricky enough, but I'll just lay it on the table and maybe we can discuss it privately. Which is, instead, this is everything I'm going to talk about now, I don't talk about conservation of energy at all. And what you're going to see is that I basically talk about kind of the force picture, the stress picture of the flow as being determined by the various forces on the flow. You could also ask about conservation of energy. And if you ask about conservation of energy, it turns out that these thermal motions of, quote, thermal motions of the particles that are, you know, in a cage and are banging back and forth and losing their energy inside a cage must, in fact, be kept track of, and that there's kind of a cascade of energy in the problem where you have macroscopic shear forces leading to dissipation, you know, that's the stress tensor times the strain rate, as you would expect from macroscopic fluid dynamics. And then you have to, then at the next scale, you understand these in terms of collisions between particles that are being brought into contact with one another. And then at the next scale, you actually say, well, when two particles collide, the energy doesn't just disappear instantaneously. That starts to create vibrations in the system, not only of those two particles, but of everything else that's around them that sees the fact that those particles have collided and their impulses that propagate through the system. And so you have to, and then you have to go down to the next scale and put in thermal energy. And then you make an argument which basically says that the energy has to flow from one level to the next level to the next level. And you end up with the same picture that I'm talking about here in terms of the overall behavior of the rheology. Why don't we do Annette, and then Ellie, and then Daniel.
Sorry. Is this diffusive time, this diffusive length scale, much larger than the mean free path between collisions?
If it is not, if this is supposed to be a dense flow, mm-hmm. So the mean free path had better be much less than d, or else this is not a sensible approach. Ellie.
You mentioned this notion of cascade, and what we find is something very intriguing, is that if you take this notion seriously, well, there are actually solutions of the Boltzmann equation that are steady state solutions even under dissipation.
Mm-hmm.
And then if what those imply is the only possible velocity distribution for such cascade states mm-hmm. are power law distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there's a recent observation by was reported at the Gordon conference by Knott of shear flow, granular shear flows. Mm-hmm. It was on the condensed matter archive 2 months ago, where they observed this power law distribution of energy. So mm-hmm. there's a particular form of the energy distribution in the system. Mm-hmm. If it is a cascade, then it is the only way it can be the power law.
Mm-hmm.
It's just there.
Right, but this presumably is also in a relatively dilute limit.
This is a very not necessarily actually. It's mm-hmm. a linear. When you think about it, it's a linear process by which energy cascades from large scale to small scales.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only one solution. It is much more general than the Boltzmann equation.
Right.
And there is hints of that, but I mean, this is all very
okay.
superficial. The notion that you introduce. Quite intriguing.
Okay. Okay, Danielle.
Yes, Thomas. This coherence length seems to be something which is rather specific to dense granular systems.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, but I may be wrong, you have used arguments which could be the same in a dilute regime. So what is specific of dense granular?
Okay, here's my problem. In a dense rate, in a dilute regime, think about the way I introduced this, which is I said that I introduced the pressure, which I said, well, if you move away from this particle you're collapsing onto, there's going to be a pressure that pushes you back. What is that pressure? Well, that pressure are collisions with other particles. Okay? So if you're in a dilute system after such collisions, there's no guarantee whatever that there's ever going to be a second collision with the original particle. So this whole picture becomes a little bit unrealistic. The advantage of the energy picture that I was alluding to, this cascade picture, is it doesn't treat this pressure in an effective way, but in a way looks at the influence of all collisions that a particle is undergoing at the same time. So that energy picture might be more, you might be able to push further into the dilute regime, but that energy picture is also going to turn into a Boltzmann equation picture sooner or later as you push it into the dilute regime.
You're talking pressure is also due to force change?
Well, the nice thing about the thermal energy picture is you can get rid of that. Because as I said, if you take the rigidity to infinity, all of the contacts become of infinitesimally short duration. And so you don't really believe in force chains anymore. But you can recover the same physics I'm talking about here in that limit by looking at the energy picture instead of looking at the force picture, which is what I'm doing here. Honestly, you're taking me in an avenue I don't want to go, because this is the way I'm doing it now, I think, is the easiest way to understand it. And one should master that before one starts to introduce some of these other complexities about how do you really take the limit of rigidity goes to infinity and so forth. Okay. Okay, so the next question is, what are the nature of the correlations? Okay, so here I must confess to having introduced an error into the literature, or perhaps an overly naive picture, because when we first wrote about this idea, we used the word E because we were thinking about eddies, meaning more or less rotational flows that would be created by all of these particles who are correlated with one another. And we now believe this to be, there's been no evidence seen for such overall vortex-like structures and granular flows. And furthermore, we also think that from a theoretical point of view, it's clear that that's too naive a way of... In dense flows?
In simulation as well as in experiment.
Overall vortices?
Yes.
Okay, well, in that case, I am clearly, I have a case of appalling peak.
I'm happy to give you the reference.
Okay. We have been misinformed then because our experimental and numerical friends have spent 2 or 3 years telling us what an absurd idea this is and how one can never see these things.
Oh,
must be right. Okay. There is a stability analysis by Mathieu Ernst for the shear instability in.
But that's in a dilute system.
Yeah, in the dilute system, these are definitely there. I don't think one can argue about this point. Probably not in the dense system.
I think it's been a different origin. Now, this is the steady state, right? It's not the after the transition to the unstable regime. Is that correct?
This is in the steady state. So the question is there some average, if you look, obviously the average flow is always horizontal. But the question is, if you looked into the flow, would you see these coherent structures rotating in the way that, one thinks of coherent structures in fluid dynamics always having a strong vortical component? And I think the best way to say is that was the picture we used at the start, but we're now considerably less confident in that picture and are seeking to replace it with a more nuanced picture, which may take us closer to or further away from what's seen experimentally or numerically. And it's not, I'm not the expert on the experiment, certainly, so there will be other people here over the course of the next 12 weeks who will know more than I do about that.
I think there's a simple argument for that they must be there. If you have a shear flow, and then you shear the top layer to one direction, the bottom layer to the other direction, how long should be this large convection cell? We have a very long shear flow, velocity at expense.
This is particles rotate. Doesn't mean the eddy.
Yeah, I mean, it
can
happen
in
water. Yeah.
Particles have to rotate at half the local vorticity, but that doesn't mean there are.
I mean, if you think about, for instance, a Couette cell, that's not necessarily the case. In a Couette cell, the vortex rolls form in the other direction.
This is a question of stability. I mean, then you shear a bit quicker than you have some. I mean.
It is not generally true in fluid flows that vortex rolls form in that direction. Okay, so with vorticity parallel to the cross product of the flow direction and the gradient direction. Okay, so. What I'd like to say is that I think we kind of know how to think about this question of what the correlations are, and what the we don't know the answer to the question of what's the macroscopic expression of these correlations. Okay. And the point is that when two particles collapse onto one another in this way, there are two kinds of couplings that appear between their velocities. The first is obvious. The normal velocity of the particles becomes zero. That's what being in long-term contact means. The second is that their frictional forces will couple the rotational with the transverse velocity of the particles. And the result of these two is a coupling equation that appears at any contact that is truly collapsed, which is if you have two particles, ij, that are in long-term contact, then vi minus vj, which I just called delta vij, is equal to 1/2 rotational angular velocity of particle I plus angular velocity of particle j cross delta wij, where this is the displacement vector. Okay. So this is basically just writing that there are three equations here. There is a normal equation, which is basically just that the delta V normal is equal to 0. And in the normal equation, basically, the cross product here is 0 in that direction. Basically because of the fact that delta Wij is the normal direction. This, incidentally, is only true for spherical particles and is considerably more complex for non-spherical particles. And then you have two transverse couplings, which are couplings of rotational, explicit couplings of the angular velocities of the particle to the transverse velocities of the centers of mass of the particles.
Thomas, if you're going to insist that, why not insist that the angular velocities are also?
That the what?
The angular velocities are also mutually.
Why? They aren't. The only requirement is that at the point of contact, the particles not be in relative motion. That's a coupling between the transverse velocity of the center of mass of the particle and the angular velocities. They are not separately constrained. They are only constrained in a linear combination.
Okay. This is this delta W is the displacement. Sorry, is the difference in positions of the two particles.
That's correct.
This equation is supposed to be true if you say only for spherical.
Yes.
And omega is the rotation.
The angular velocity.
The rotation of an individual particle by its own center.
Yes. Written as an axial vector.
So you're giving rotational motion of individual particles a central role in this.
Yes.
In this theory, even though it's undoubtedly heavily damped.
Well, it's not in the steady state flow. It's there. I mean, Kumaran is right. Most of these particles are rotating with an omega that is you know, a finite fraction of the local shear rate. Okay. All right, now this is the first equation. There's actually a second equation, which you can get by taking the derivative with respect to time, which gives you a difference in the accelerations of the two particles, and I won't bother to write out the right-hand side. It's a straightforward derivative of the right-hand side, and again, depends only on kinematical quantities such as angular accelerations and velocities of particles. Okay?
So what is this first equation? This looks like a definition.
It's not a definition. This part is a definition. I'm just saying Vi minus Vij I call delta. This is the constraint equation, which is that the surface points of the two particles should not be in relative motion.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you construct the velocity at the contact point of one sphere and the velocity at the contact point of the other sphere, and these have to be equal.
Correct.
Okay. Sorry, what is the second equation?
The second equation is the derivative with respect to time of this equation. And the point there is simply that you can also derive a linear relation connecting the accelerations from the assumption that this contact is long-lasting.
So I'm missing something. Can't the particles have a translational tangential component of velocity?
Yes, and that appears in this.
Would it might have been easier to explain if you could break down the tangential velocity, well, the velocity.
The velocity at the contact point is the center of mass velocity plus a component that's omega cross r. So this is basically the sum of those two is equal to zero with the right signs put in. And so it's interesting that you get the plus here, which is basically because you get 1/2 wij in one direction, minus 1/2 wij in the other direction.
I don't see how differentiating an equation of motion gives you additional information.
It doesn't, but thinking about it, all of the information is the only information there is that you're assuming that the thing is true for order delta t squared and not just, for a little bit longer. But you know, it's a handy equation to have for reasons that I'm going to explain in a moment. Okay. So the fine. So one of the things that you immediately can do with this is the Edwards counting argument. Ask how many degrees of freedom do you have in the system? And that's pretty straightforward. Basically, if the number of such contacts defines an average coordination number z, then do we need a coffee or a bathroom break, or should I keep going? I don't know. I have no idea what time it is.
It's 11:10, so we should probably take 5 minutes and come back.
Okay, fine. Let's take 5 minutes and come back, and then I can get some more coffee too. Yes.
So I'll print you this papers on cascades.
Okay, good.
And although we are being extremely honest on calling it gases, you will see this all follow from the collision rule.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing about it. It's a linear.
Okay, I mean that might be relevant to what we're thinking about then.
The mean free path is not important, right?
The mean free path is tiny compared to all other length scales in the system.
Collision dynamics should not be the driving.
Probably not, but one said that it is. The cascade has only one form. It's uniquely mm-hmm. defined, and it implies a power law distribution of velocity,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, tells you that temperature may or may not be integrable.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe an ill-defined quantity, depending on the particular. It is very subtle. What is true about those cascades is the energy dissipation rate is infinite.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's actually a lot like wave turbulence.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Okay, I'll have to see.
And curiously enough, these experiments
mm-hmm.
that were reported in Maine
mm-hmm.
see that. And the exponent they see is V minus 5, 6,
mm-hmm.
Roughly the number that they see. But
right.
I think yours is truncated. I don't think you have, you have 10 collisions
mm-hmm.
basically dissipate the entire energy, if I understand.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
And most of the locking occurs in the first few collisions.
R is 0.9, all you need is 10 collisions. So,
yeah.
I mean, maybe you're talking correlation length of 5 particles.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Schutz law,
that's a lot, it's big.
That's what you need, really.
Yeah.
You don't need. Okay.
Well, the coffee is taking a little while to come. We'll also see how much wasted we get, how many people don't come back.
Actually, it might be a good idea to begin when we come back by telling us what the outcome is going to be. Instead of just plodding through.
Yeah.
So we can see where it is.
Mm-hmm.
What
I've gotten through 2 pages of my 5-page notes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
That's what people are learning much more than they would by just reading But it's a little hard to see how you're going to get continual equations on it.
Well,
this stuff, but that happens.
Yeah, that happens.
So I guess one of the strengths of this approach is that the continual equations are sort of derived rather than pulled out of the hat.
Right.
And it's been tested numerically as well.
Well, we are actually in the interesting thing is that I mean, Plulikin saw these correlations. I won't call them eddies. I'll call them correlations in the surfaces of the flow. So we are now looking numerically for correlations because we think we now, for reasons that we didn't understand originally, but we now understand, if you do most of the obvious ways of looking for velocity correlations, it doesn't work. You have to do, you basically get overwhelmed by noise if you do the most straightforward things. And so we actually learned from Plulikin because he used an averaging time in his observations, I think basically just because he was forced to, because of the way his PIV software was working. And then it kind of tumbled to us that we needed to do averaging when we looked at the numerical things as well, that if you look at equal time correlations, you get too much noise.
So do you look at the velocity at different points averaged over time to expect this length, or?
Yes, that's what we're trying to do now.
And this is what Plulikin did.
And this is what Plulikin did in this FISREV letter that was recently published.
I like your remark about the dissipation. I mean, it's, in hydrodynamics, we also have this dissipation length, right? I mean, identifying this edge stop with the...
Okay, I'm going to fetch myself a little bit of coffee and then I'll restart.
Yes, I don't know.
Both of them are being determined by something that is microscopic, which is common to both of them.
Okay.
Right.
In the flowing machine, the fluid knows something about the condition that would come to stop it.
I think it was counterintuitive in the sense that nobody thought of it before Plulikin.
I don't know, in fluid dynamics, let's suppose you're looking at
she talks to
batteries. A lot of things depend on the threshold, on how far you are above the threshold.
Except what Plulikin did, I think it is, you would say, let's define a new number, which is the Golub number, and that number is going to be the Rayleigh number divided by the Rayleigh number threshold. And we're going to collapse everything in terms of the Golub number. Now, in that case, it's obviously kind of the same as collapsing it in terms of the Rayleigh number.
People do that.
Yeah.
When they're dealing with, not with onset phenomena, but with phenomena that occur above.
Right.
Above onset.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to predict
to get image quality,
the actual amplitudes of the flows that stabilize.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
They usually, I think, they depend on maximalist distance above onset. That's
right.
Typical.
Not Rayleigh minus Rayleigh onset, but Rayleigh minus Rayleigh onset divided by Rayleigh onset.
Sometimes people subtract one, and sometimes people subtract one.
Right.
Right. Yeah, there's a subtle point here that it is converges to H stop and not to H start.
Yeah. H start, the critical angle, which of course is a little bit above this line. Yeah.
The reason it converges to H stop is because H stop is the point at which the flow is not generating enough energy for it to.
Yeah, H start has only a dynamical meaning. H stop also is an energy conservation meaning.
Yeah.
That's the reason it's called
H-stop
rather than
H-stop. Right. Okay, I think I should get started again. Jerry suggests that we should that I should turn to the last page of the book so that you have some motivation for continuing to sit here. And and so I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to go back to what I was saying before. I mean, the goal here, where I'm going is basically to try to show you how, from this kind of physical picture, you can recover everything I've written on this side of the board, including Pulikin flow rule, although naturally not the fact this is 0.14 and not 0.18. This picture and the dependence on this scaling variable, as well as the overall structure of this phase diagram. So that's my goal here is to basically understand those things. Okay.
And so why do you call it a constituted relation? What do you mean by?
I am going to write down a formula for the stress tensor in a general flow as a function of shear rate. I would claim that, and that formula will involve things like the pressure, and I will claim that that's what's known as constitutive relation.
I think to leave something undetermined, if you have a formula for the stress tensor, which depends upon the pressure. Carry on.
Shear component of the stress tensor. Shear component of the stress tensor. And I have no theory. I'll say at the outset, I have no theory of anomalous normal stresses in these flows. Okay. So fine. So let me just finish the discussion about the correlations in the collapse structure. So n sub f. First of all, there's a reduction in the number of degrees of freedom, which is what correlations kind of means. When you say something is correlated, you say that the number of degrees of freedom has been reduced, which is 3/2 times 4 minus z. So this is basically the Edwards argument, but not coming from above in a solid, but coming from below in a liquid, and saying in order to have some degrees of freedom left so that you can have a flow at all, you'd better have the average coordination number less than 4. And in fact, the extent to which it's less than 4, this defines the number of degrees of freedom you've got left over to make the thing actually flow somewhere after all of these particles have collapsed onto one another and are coupled in their motions. Okay. The second observation is that the forces are actually determined. And that observation is that each of these, at each contact, you have 3 forces. At this equation, there are 3 of these equations at every contact. Okay. Therefore, when you take the derivative of this equation, which adds no new information, it's true, but expresses all of these in terms of objects like accelerations and angular accelerations, those objects are basically determined by the forces in the system, and you've got exactly the number of equations in order to determine all of those forces in the systems from the linear relations connecting the accelerations and the angular accelerations. So a remarkable feature of the collapsed state is that if you modulo questions of loading at the boundary and so forth, the interparticle forces at all of these contacts are actually uniquely determined by the requirement that they be long-lived contacts. So it's actually a rather remarkable feature of this collapsed state. Okay. The other comment is that suppose I fix all of the forces in order to require these contacts to continue to be long-lived, and I have a few degrees of freedom left over, so the thing is still flowing. Can I integrate forward this set of equations indefinitely? And the answer is no. Because 2 kinds of things happen to the motion described by this coupled set of equations over all contacts. The first is that particles collide, meaning that suddenly, in the course of the integration forward of this flow, a new contact is created. And when that new contact is created, there are a lot of impulses that get transmitted through the network and so forth. Maybe some contacts someplace else break. So you basically have to analyze the collision. At the end of the collision, you have a new set of equations describing a new set of contacts, with the initial conditions that are the result of that collision, and then you integrate those forward. Okay? The second thing that can happen has to do with these forces. I told you that specifying a set of contacts and requiring that they be long-lived contacts uniquely determines the forces in the network. Okay? However, those forces have an additional constraint, which is they've all got to be obey Coulomb's constraints in terms of the tangential force being less than or equal to the coefficient of friction times the normal force, and also the normal force has to be positive and not negative. Okay. So, because everything is developing continuously, if you have a network where all of those constraints are satisfied, you do expect to be able to integrate forward these equations for a while and keep them satisfied, but sooner or later you're going to break one of those constraints, in which case you get failure of a contact. So those are the two kinds of processes that create and destroy contacts and would appear as discontinuities in the integration forward of this set of equations. So that's, you know, obviously a somewhat deep and not, you know, we don't completely understand what the properties are of this, these, you know, solutions, these equations, and so forth. However, our claim is that the what we mean by a correlated region of particles is that it's a region of particles whose dynamics are determined by this set of equations reflecting the presence of long-lived contacts. So it's, you know, the order parameter is the extent to which the velocities and angular velocities of the particles are mapping onto a set of such velocities which reflect a solution to these equations. Okay, okay, so that gets me to the end of page 3. Okay. And now I'd like to go back to the more phenomenological discussion. Okay, now there is an overall, I think I should restart here.
Well,
yes?
So you laid out the picture here. Does a particular measurable quantity, so say we at your disposal, the perfect experiment, physical or numerical, what is the particular measurable relation or quantity that would confirm or
confirm that one wouldn't, isn't it, say? Unfortunately, the only thing I could do would be to take this set of equations, to look at the contact network, pull out this set of linear equations, solve for the forces between the contacts, and then compare them to the experimentally seen forces.
But that's a microscopic comparison.
It's like a you know, one of these glass order parameters. It's an order parameter that reflects the extent to which the state you're seeing is the same as a highly disordered state. So that's why it's, you know, so there may be some higher order susceptibilities or something, as in glasses, that could be measured, which would function as a proxy for the order parameter. But the true order parameter is not very accessible.
But can one, number one and number two, just quantify and measure how those two processes are competing, or no?
Well, I mean, you could. I mean, if you looked into a flow, I mean, what are you, you're going to see things colliding all the time, and after a while they kind of stop and they go and collide with somebody else, right? And what we're saying is, well, those ones that are colliding all the time, you know, maybe they're bouncing back and forth over some very small distance, but they are, you know, starting to approximate this constraint at the contact between them. Okay. So, if we were talking about just a simple Newtonian fluid, we would normally just, the constitutive equation for a Newtonian fluid is for the shear component of the stress, which I write as sigma, is pretty simple. It's sigma equals the viscosity times the shear rate. Okay? And this viscosity has dimensionally is equal to a density times a length scale, which I'll call L mu squared, times a time scale, which I'll write as gamma dot. Okay? Now, so far I've done nothing. What I've really done is I've said, in terms of the shear rate and the shear component of the stress tensor, I am going to define a length scale, L sub mu, by the appropriate combination of shear rate, gamma dot, and rho, which is just the definition of something that has dimensions of length, which is L sub mu.
However, it is disturbing because in a Newtonian fluid, I would assume that there should be a linear relation between sigma and the shear rate, right?
No, in Newtonian fluid, there's a temperature to the half in viscosity. He's replaced that by gamma dot, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So gamma dot is going to be inverse gamma dot is only 10 scales. So.
I'm emphasizing the ad hoc, you know, the fact that I haven't done anything, simply because suppose I had completely mistaken the physics of my problem and the relevant time scales were, I mean, suppose, for instance, that I assumed it was athermal, but I just bungled it was some colloidal system that was in fact thermal. The result, this would still be true. It would just mean that I had to change the way I thought about L mu, because I would now have to fix the all this time scale issue by incorporating a 1 over gamma dot into L mu and a square root of t. So I can always, you know, brush everything I don't understand into, you know, the one undefined quantity L mu.
You have to put a modulus there.
A modulus?
Yeah, if you reverse the flow, the viscosity should change sign.
It should be more
gamma dot. Gamma dot is positive.
That's fine. I'm not going to bother with that. Okay.
No, so from going from t power half to gamma dot, there is, it's non-analytic at gamma dot equal to zero.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Which is a characteristic of any Bagnold type viscosity expression. Okay. Okay.
This is a standard type of approach in all turbulence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And We actually, this is one thing I like about GDR MIDI, which is that when we did this, I mean, Denise and I basically called this Prandtl mixing length, and but we never put that in our paper because we thought, you know, if we put, I mean, referees, I mean, that's it's over if we say that. And so GDR MIDI, in their section that talks about our theory, calls the headline is the Prandtl mixing length theory. Okay, so now comes the part that has some physics in it.
There's one thing. L mu is not supposed to depend on gamma dot.
At this point, I don't think it depends on gamma dot, which is why I wrote it this way. But at this point, I've made no assumptions whatsoever about L mu. I'm about to say what my assumption is about L mu.
Right.
It's clearly dimensional. L mu can be anything.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so. So now is where I actually say something that could be right or wrong. As I say that L mu has the form of some unknown constant times L sub e, which is perfectly well defined over here, incidentally, in terms of local properties of the fluid, times 1 plus b tilde d over L sub e. Okay. Thus, presumably, higher order things in D over L sub e. Okay. So, there are two parts of this that are interesting. The first, of course, is saying it's the same as L sub e. Okay. And the physical motivation there is very much like the physical motivation that people would have in turbulence, is to say that there's an effective scale which is determining an effective viscosity, because, you know, you basically assume that the things that below this scale, the flow is so highly correlated that you can kind of view it as creating a region that then, you know, acts like a new fluid on a higher scale. It's a conventional sort of, I mean, you can like it or dislike it, but, you know, this particular kind of sleaziness has a long history in fluid mechanics. The second part of this that's interesting is what I've done here. writing, keeping track of the finite size terms explicitly is something that I'm obliged to do here, and you'll shortly understand why. And writing the finite size corrections this way is perfectly reasonable. However, I've chosen to write it with a plus sign and not with a minus sign. So the basic idea I have here is that L mu is maybe just a little bit bigger than L sub e. There are two basic ways of trying to justify that. The first is, you're going to see that if I don't do it that way, it's just a disaster. Okay. Right. The second is, if you want to justify this, you might say, well, let's suppose that these quantities are getting small. Okay. Well, L mu, you know, what did Bagnold say? Bagnold said that L mu was D, basically. And in fact, you don't really, to say that L mu is less than D really doesn't make much sense in terms of the behavior of the flow. On the other hand, in that limit, as L sub E is, L sub D is going to zero, or as L sub mu is going to D, L sub E is actually going to zero. So I do claim that, now of course that could happen because of, you know, higher order terms in this expansion or whatever, because you're going down to places where D over L sub E is not only small, it's maybe quite large. Okay. However, at this, if I want to recover that physics, that we expect that L sub mu is in fact larger than L sub E, at this level of the approximation, the only way to do it is to keep a plus sign here.
Why not just write L mu equal D plus A plus LE? If you want to ensure it's never less than D.
That's kind of what I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's. I mean, that's exactly what I did here.
But LE less than D makes no sense in terms of your argument about where it came from, I know.
It does, however, make sense in, if I look at L mu in this equation. I want this equation still to work in the case where there's no collapse at all, and in that case, I should be back to a Bagnold-type theory, and L mu should be D. And that, so in that, in the Bagnold limit, L sub mu is D and L sub E is zero. Okay? And so I claim that by putting the plus sign in here, I have been able to recover that limit within this equation. But of course, there are more complex ways of doing that, but this is the simplest way. Okay? Okay. So, honestly, at this stage, I'm kind of done, because this is all I need to, on what's on the board is all I need to have this, these constitutive relations, you know, modulo the fact that, you know, I'm not bothering with anomalous normal stresses and stuff. Okay? So, let's write it in terms of the viscosity mu. And the result is mu is equal to rho times gamma dot times L sub mu squared, which is A tilde squared. Then I have L sub E squared, 1 over this, I go back to F of epsilon P over rho divided by gamma dot squared. And then I have a 1 plus B tilde, and then I have D over L sub E, which is F tilde of epsilon D gamma dot divided by square root of P over rho plus dot dot dot, plus high, basically higher order terms in this object I. And so this is the claimed this, you know, plus this, of course, which is how I define the viscosity, is the claimed constitutive relation. And I'll just clean it up a little bit. And that's what it looks like. Okay? All right. So, now, how about plane shear? So in plane shear, F sub t per unit area is just going to be sigma, the shear component of the stress tensor. And F sub n is going to be related to the pressure by this screwy 1 plus k over 2 factor. So for plane shear, the prediction is F sub t over F sub n is equal to, first of all, we have the a tilde squared over F. Then we have pressure. And the pressure is 1 plus k over 2 times the force per unit area on the surface. The 1 over gamma dot basically cancels when we multiply it into the gamma dot that we had here in sigma. And the F sub n goes to the other side. And then we have a 1 plus basically B tilde, F tilde. We have a square root of 1 plus k over 2. And then we have the parameter I. So this is basically a Bingham rheology. You have a yield stress, which is given by, you know, constants and has some, this is over small f, has some, you know, dependence on the coefficient of restitution. And then you have a linear term here in the...
Just a minute. The Bingham rheology, if Fm was a constant, but I mean, it's actually more like a more Coulomb. It's more like a Coulomb.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm saying the term I'm using, the reason I use the word Bingham is because of the appearance of a constant plus I. Which is, I mean, it has the stabilizing property of the Bingham rheology.
It's the same thing you would get if you did those hybrid models, right, where you end up a frictional and a kinetic part of the stress.
Absolutely.
Exactly the same.
Absolutely.
Well, the kinetic part's different, though.
No, the kinetic part is the same. The frictional part has the pressure in it.
Well, the kinetic part has the pressure in it, too, through the parameter I.
Yeah, the kinetic part would be gamma dot squared.
Yeah.
But it's not in this.
But the kinetic part, I thought, came by canceling out LE on both sides.
The kinetic part, I'm sorry, canceling out LE on both sides?
Yeah, it comes from the B tilde.
It comes from this B tilde term, but this is a 1 plus, this multiplies this. But the gamma dots all canceled out of the front because I had a 1 over gamma dot from the definition of mu and then a gamma dot that came back in since when I looked at the stress tensor.
The kinetic part comes out of canceling B tilde, which cancels out LE. Right? And LE is the only one that contains the pressure.
Except I took it to the other side.
Yeah, okay.
So,
but if you wrote the equation for the stress, it would be the exact background expression.
Yeah,
right, the part.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the other part is the frictional.
Well, except no. The dependence on pressure is different from the I mean, maybe talking about different bag modes.
Okay. Well, the frictional part has the pressure instead of the normal stress, right?
Yes.
But usually in the frictional models, they take it at the yield surface.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's what Jim was saying. So, yeah, it's different because it's not the same. The frictional part is not the same.
Yeah.
Because they take it at the yield surface and they assume it's on the yield surface.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's flowing.
Yeah. Okay. I think this is the discussion of what exactly is the relationship between this and Bagnall, we should probably have privately, because I think we'll lose people on that. I mean, anyway, this is the result of this picture. Okay. That tells you about the plane shear. And basically, it says that you should be linear. And so you'll notice that I remarked that there was some curve linear here with the slope depending on coefficient of restitution, which is seen. And you'll notice that I remarked that, well, down here, there seems to be some curvature, which maybe I don't understand. And that would be the limit of I becomes small. However, you should note also that as L sub E gets larger than the size of the system, if L sub E that you computed with this were greater than the overall size of the shear cell, you would begin to question whether or not the flow is mobile at all. So in fact, the stuff that goes on down here, the fact that it's a little screwy encourages rather than discourages me, because what I would tend to think is that in general, once L sub E starts to get comparable to the size of your system, you're going to see highly non-universal behavior anyway, depending on the exact geometry of your system. Okay. All right, now how about the chute flow example? So I can do the same thing for chute flow. For chute flow, the shear stress is basically, so sigma is basically rho g depth sine theta, and the pressure is 1 plus k over 3, now because we're in three dimensions, times rho gz cosine theta. That's just the conversion from normal force to stress, to pressure. Okay. So if I do that, I hope I have all of the numbers right. No, this is the wrong. This is, it's still flame here. Tangent theta is equal to a tilde squared 1 plus k over 3. Divided by F of epsilon times 1 plus 2 b tilde square root of F tilde square root 1 plus k over 3 gamma dot d, and now writing it out explicitly, divided by square root of d z cosine theta plus dot dot dot. Okay, so what have I done here? I basically said the pressure goes like cosine theta, the shear stress goes like sine theta. So I took the sine theta and the cosine theta over to the left-hand side to make a tangent theta. I got a big mess of constants left over, and then I wrote my scaling variable here just a little bit more explicitly. Okay. So. Let's call this object tangent theta naught, and then write tangent theta minus tangent theta naught times is basically equal to an overall constant, which I'll just call capital B tilde, times gamma dot d, or the square root of dz cosine theta. Right? From this, what you see is that at a fixed angle, theta, you basically must have that gamma dot is scaling as the square root of z. So the shear rate is increasing as the square root of the depth in the flow, which is the classic Bagnold rheology, which is, in fact, exactly what's turning up again in the Poulikin flow rule, except with this H stop that appears. Okay. I'm sorry, you have a question?
See, that's the overall shear rate, the average shear rate?
That's the local shear rate.
The local shear rate.
And that will imply that the volume fraction is a constant.
Yes.
But that is only for,
Well, actually, the thing that implies that the volume fraction is a constant is the fact that if you compute the fact that this is D over L, so since this object is constant as a function of depth, because there's no depth dependence on the left-hand side, therefore the length scale L sub E is independent of depth. Therefore, and L sub E is the only thing that's describing the structure, so therefore the density should be independent of depth as well.
Isn't your F epsilon also a function of the density of
time? It is, yeah, but there's, but that, that, so the point is that on the left-hand side, there's nothing that is a function of density. So on the right-hand side, there can't be anything that's a function of density, you know, the right-hand side cannot be a function of density either, which says that L is basically not a function of density. It's,
so sorry, why did we lose that pressure time scale law in this case?
Because well, the pressure was square root of G, the square root of GZ came from pressure. Okay. I have one more comment to make, and then I think it's time to let people go to lunch and, you know, maybe reflect on this or not as they prefer. Which is the object I. So the object I, you'll notice, is basically proportional to various stuff, but the largest proportionality is to tangent theta minus tangent theta naught. Which, of course, is going to zero near threshold.
Yeah, that's okay. The H-stop term.
Right. So therefore, you conclude that since I is equal to D over L sub E, that L sub E is proportional to 1 over tangent theta minus tangent theta naught. Okay. Right. And if you say that L sub E is H stop, again, the same argument I was using with the plane shear, that once L sub E becomes larger than the overall scale of the system, the flow should no longer be mobile at all, then you would predict that H stop should go like 1 over tangent theta minus 1 over tangent theta naught, which is, in fact, exactly the fitting form that Poulikin used, if you go back and look at his original paper.
Not for the first time.
Not in 99, you're right, not in 99, but in more recent work of Poulikin and Fortaire, they use 1 over tangent theta minus tangent theta naught as a standard fitting.
But both are working as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a big deal. I mean, what the fitting form is isn't a big deal, because there are a million things that will run through the error bars.
I mean, it's the linear piece of the tangent that's playing the role.
I mean, it's the 1 over theta minus theta naught is as good as anything else.
We're not worried about it.
All right. But the so that is you know, that's basically our theory of this curve. Over here, you'll notice that if we said that the other limit, of course, where our theory will break down is when L sub E is equal to D, and then that occurs at a fixed angle. And so the other prediction of the theory is that the boundary to whatever is the kind of flow which is no longer dominated by these coherent structures, but in which the particles are truly independent of one another, that boundary should be a vertical line in this phase diagram. And in the shoot flow case, that would be, that matches with what's seen for the transition to the accelerating flow. Okay, that's all.
It's nice. With your L mu, if you don't drop the square term, then you get kinetic theory in the limit of high shear rates, which would be nice. I would say.
You mean if I continued this out?
No. If you just keep the linear, if you keep it like that, but when you square it and go to the next line, you drop the
D. Oh, actually, incidentally, I forgot that I shouldn't put in a 2, right.
But if you keep that term, then that corresponds to a kinetic.
The Chapman-Enskog type terms.
Yeah, which would be nice.
Yeah. And
then you've got, I mean, because people have always tried adding, you know, frictional type forces to these, but this
right.
gives the motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Interpolation for both, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and adding up also implies that these stresses are being transmitted in parallel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because if it were in series, you would add up strains.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that's the basic implication here. You're assuming there's some amount of stress being transmitted by these force chains and some amount by collisions.
Yes.
Is there evidence for that?
Well, I mean, all of the stress is transmitted by either forced, by either short-lived contacts or by long-lived contacts. So almost by definition, that's true.
No, but if you add it in parallel, that means that you have to have sample-spanning force chains.
Well, I don't believe there are sample spanning force chains because I doubt if there are any force chains on a scale larger than L sub B.
They just both contribute to the transmission of stress. If you think about a chain, you've got gaps, and across that the transmission is essentially kinetic, and you've got solid particles across which.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean it's all really encoded in this assumption.
No, but then the system should be more complicated, right? Because it becomes a sort of series parallel circuit.
But in these dense systems, there's a limit how complicated it can get because this could support the stress tensor.
No.
Okay, and what about the other normal stress?
Well, I mean, I don't know about anomalous normal stresses. What we see numerically in three dimensions is that if you look at the stress along the flow direction versus sigma zz, they are almost but not exactly the same.
No, the question I'm asking is it close to the Mohr Coulomb surface?
Nowhere near the Mohr, but in the numerics, it's nowhere near the Mohr Coulomb surface.
The coefficient that you get, okay.
Yes. I mean, the anomalous stresses are much smaller than you would expect to see if you were anywhere near the Mohr Coulomb stress surface.
So usually when we speak of a constitutive rho, it deals with all components of the stress tensor.
We have a tensor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Here, two components at least play a role.
Right.
Here and normal one.
Right.
Okay. And in fact, you were somewhat obliged to use a constitutive role for the shear component.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But you just have used the equation of motion, not constitutive role for the normal pressure. Do you see any rationale for that?
Well, I know what the normal pressure is in both of these problems.
But you don't need it. You have just used the equation of motion that P is proportional to rho Gz plus mu theta.
Yeah.
So, well, I am ready to accept that, but I don't understand from rational point of view.
Okay. Well, these are both problems where both the shear and the normal component of the stress tensor are determined by the boundaries or by the loading on the system, but the actual shear rate is not so determined.
There should be an implied equation between P and phi, but because density is not changing much, it doesn't matter.
Right.
So you're just dropping that equation out, so you don't need.
No, but P is an enforced external.
Yeah, no, right. I mean, if you actually wanted to.
Right. I mean, this actually raises a very interesting question, which is that of what is the volume fraction? How does the volume fraction fit into this theory? Okay, and we don't have very convincing arguments for at the moment, is that the volume fraction, the dominant term in the volume fraction is linear in 1 over L. In the free volume, although there may also be, under some circumstances, a significant contribution of 1 over L squared as well. But the dominant behavior seems to be linear in 1 over L. And we have numerical evidence for that, and we have some arguments for that, but we're not sure they're, that convincing. So if you wanted to put volume fraction in as a separate variable, and there might be, for instance, flows where you controlled the volume fraction, the way you would do it would be by basically writing down what the local volume fraction meant in terms of L sub E, and then you could plug back into this theory and do anything you wanted.
Can I just recycle Danielle's question as a comment? These systems are close to jam.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is, in terms of Danielle's comment, what you're deriving is, rather than what would conventionally be called the constitutive equation, you're deriving the inverse constitutive equation.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting the shear rates in terms of the stresses rather than the stresses in terms of the shear history.
Right.
And there's a very nice tie-up to David Pine's talk.
Mm-hmm.
Where he made the point that if he wanted to understand the rheology of those suspensions around jamming conditions, the sensible experiments to make are experiments that control stress.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The underlying theme that fits here. That
yes. And in terms of my coordination number argument, the way I would describe, a very quasi-static flow, such as his jamming flows, is that they are certainly described by these contact mobility equations, but he is operating in a regime where you create a few more contacts than you are destroying in the course of the flow, as a result of which you eventually jam. So Z creeps up, and when it hits 4, it's over.
I think philosophically, it's a big point that you're sidestepping some difficult determinacy about the normal stresses by posing the problem the other way around and asking the shear rate.
Absolutely.
Given shear stress, given stress tensor,
right.
Rather than.
Right. And that I think honestly that's fortuitous, and it came out of the fact it's fortuitous rather than because of our deep reflections on whether to fix the stress and determine the shear rate or vice versa, because of the fact that we had a specific problem that we were where the stresses we knew the stresses and we didn't know the shear rate that we were trying to understand.
Well, I'm trying to argue that you may be profoundly correct.
Well, normally I'm profoundly incorrect, so I prefer it that way. Yes.
Could I ask a different question? In the plane shear flow, you haven't said anything about the velocity profile. Was it just assumed to be linear?
They say that in the numerics that it was pretty linear. I mean, this is in the figure 1 or figure 2 of GER MIDI.
I mean, so you're assuming this is you were intending to describe a two-dimensional case where it really is linear rather than the three-dimensional cases where usually it isn't linear.
That's correct.
Couldn't we think of that? I mean, I'm just trying to find the limits of this and where it's true, where it really helps and doesn't help. It seems to me that the origin of shear banding is something that's not yet contained in this.
Right.
It might be hidden somewhere, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you would have to have a geometry in which, I mean, the thing, the thing that really comes out of this robustly is the kind of Bingham or Bingham-Bagnold or whatever form that you're getting here. And so you would want to ask the question of, is this a geometry and a loading where this kind of rheology is gives you shear banding or not? And this term tends to stabilize against shear banding, but not in all geometries and not in all loadings.
This comes down to that the effect of friction as a function of R. I mean, it has to decrease in some ways, unstable, which is not what they showed at all. But they also got velocity profiles which were 3 over 2, as well as linear, depending on the experiment and the simulation. So they said you can get both.
Yes, but whether it's 3 over 2 or linear, neither one is your banding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, exactly. But all of their stuff had this increasing effective friction with I, and it would have to decrease at some point for it to be unstable.
Yeah.
In order to get your banding, it has to decrease.
Yeah, I mean, there has to be some instability, but here, you know, the more...
Yeah, I mean...
Shear is more in some region, locally,
it gets tougher.
The friction increases.
Yes,
it has to go the other way to be unstable.
Right. So this is not... You know, again, there. I mean, this kind of rheology, the prejudice is that it's stable against shear banding, but not necessarily in all. Also, of course, you can have instability. You know, this goes back to the discussion about local stability isn't the be all and end all either. I mean, if you actually create a region of very small eddies, that might be a more robust solution than the one with a continuous strain rate.
The qualitative explanation that always appealed to me about shear banding was that near a boundary, at least, when you shear, you create a region of locally excited and dilated material,
mm-hmm.
which flows much more freely. In other words, it would go down
mm-hmm.
In that region.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is. This is getting into the issue that suppose you fix the average volume fraction rather than fixing the stress. If you fix the average volume fraction instead of fixing the stress, one could imagine that what would happen would be you would generate a high viscosity region with low volume fraction, where L sub E was small, as well as a low viscosity region with higher volume fraction where L sub E was large. And depending on, you know, what you fix when you do the system, I simply don't know whether that's, you know, whether that could be recovered within this theory or not.
I think you have to get, let the volume expand. I don't know whether you get shear banding in situations where you have no ability to expand overall.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess you do in geophysical situations.
Cartesian or something. Often, the shear banding is Cartesian in geophysical.
That's another source. Which
right. The honest answer is I don't know.
No.
It seems to me that's an area that is... Shear banding is so widespread
mm-hmm.
that it seems to me it's one of the cases that should be dealt with in forming a full picture of granular flow.
Right.
But I think it is complicated, and as you point out, it does tend to be somewhat dependent on geometry. And
mm-hmm.
the reason for the shear banding may be different in different geometries, so maybe it isn't simple.
Oh.
Thanks, that's really, really nice.
Mm-hmm.